When you see injustice, say something about it. Speak up or write a letter. You can write a letter to the editor. You can make a phone call to a legislator about issues. You don't have to leave your own home or your couch. You still can do something.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Life is for the Living. I'm your host, Rebecca Richman. We have now met all of our guests individually, so we're going to turn to their thoughts on activism together. What are the most effective methods? What were their biggest successes? And what were their worst failures? Keys to effective activism is simply getting people to pay attention.
Well, I think that the community needs to have information. If people have information, they will do the right things. And so, to me, rallies and protests and demonstrations serve the purpose of education. You can invite people to come to something, to a forum or whatever, and a handful of people will show up, and they're usually the ones that already know these things. That's true of the people who are demonstrating also, but the demonstration, if you've prepared properly, will have media attention, and that spreads the information to a wider audience, and you're able to get your message through, hopefully, if you're lucky. That's why I tried to get arrested a few times, because then you have this ongoing case, and it keeps coming up because you're getting ready for a hearing, and so-and-so took this action in support of this person who has been arrested and is being threatened with prison. That can serve a purpose too. But I just think that, most people don't think about, like, especially immigration. There are very few people paying attention to immigration. And so even when Governor Abbott and Governor DeSantis do stupid things, it does bring attention to the issue of immigration. And so in some ways, we are benefiting, those of us who want to change immigration laws, are benefiting from their foolishness. But anything that brings more attention to it, the public does not understand immigration. They don't know the situation for these people. They don't, they just aren't following it. And I can understand that, because it's not a pretty picture. And, you don't want to spend your time thinking about awful things.
I think, honestly, when you get out in the street and you protest for something, an injustice, for police brutality, then you are literally giving them your body. You are voting with your feet. Your presence establishes this kind of verity of anger, outrage, cry for justice, for remedy, for resource. So I'm kind of a fan of that kind of advocacy. And the other kind of advocacy, I think, again, is, those, certainly the internal advocacy, it's not for the faint of heart. But I would also say that the simple conversations that we have in our workplaces, in our schools, in our social spaces, where we can raise consciousness, where somebody can understand why we are passionate about a particular social justice issue. Raising consciousness has been something that's been going on forever, and it's essential that we do that to bring an understanding to people who haven't really thought about it yet. And if they're our friends, and we do it, or family, and we do it in a gentle way, then they'll know where we stand, even if they disagree with us. And they'll have to kind of consider it. It's a cumulative thing, honestly. I mean, the way culture changes is through sustained discourse, where we continue to push points forward so that people can understand it and eventually, hopefully, contextualize it within their own lives.
Belinda echoed that idea that those personal conversations can really be the most impactful.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people I work with were working in a context of their job, right? Their day-to-day job. And so, you know, I think one thing that a lot of people can do is, you know, when something happens and you know that it's not right, right? It's a comment, it's a somebody gets talked over, it's a, you know, maybe it's an inappropriate joke. It's a person getting promoted where somebody else has been overlooked who is more qualified. Like whatever you see happening, start to speak up about that. Even if that's in the form of asking questions, right? Even if that's saying to somebody, okay, well, tell me what you're thinking was here. Why this and not that? Let's unpack it. Let's explore it. If we don't start making, we can't solve problems that we can't see. So if we don't start making these things visible and discussable, then they just carry on, right? They have their own momentum. The enemy of change is the status quo. It's just things continuing as they are. And so I think it's to start to see yourself as a change agent, even if it's in these small moments, and even if it's through inquiry, right? Instead of advocacy, both work. Ask questions, try to understand, help other people understand. Or maybe you want to go more on the advocacy side where you want to speak up on behalf of something that's happening and say, hey, I don't see it that way, and here's why.
And Susie, of course, likes to get her hands dirty by fixing problems directly for individuals who are suffering.
I guess I would call it personal helping. I don't know what else to call it, but I'm actually directly helping somebody with a problem or a need that's pretty basic. And it should lead to activism if the people are paying attention. That most of the things you have to get active about are pretty basic.
And this matched up with my own experience.
I can't claim to be an activist, but I was working with a immigrant justice for a little while. And I remember like the thing that sort of really, it felt like it made an impact, but it was like such a small thing, is I drove a father and his two kids to the airport.
Yeah.
Because they had been dumped at a hotel by ICE. And it was just like he had never been on an airplane. So I was having to explain in my very like basic Spanish, like, no agua, no jugo. Like I had to like, it never even occurred to me before I was like there. I was like, oh, you have like water and juice in your bag and you can't take that through.
Yeah.
I hope he got where he wanted to go, but it was a small thing.
No, it's not a small thing. It's taking into account what the person really needs.
Yeah.
And accounting for the disability or whatever it is, the language and the culture that you have to know that. People that try to help other people that have, and they don't know anything about the culture.
Yeah.
They take only the assumptions that they can make from their own experience.
Belinda, Susie, and Jan all found their biggest wins in seeing the changes that they have made in individuals' lives.
But I would say the places where I feel like I make the biggest difference are probably in the one-on-one interactions, whether that's coaching, that might be, you know, women in our year-long leadership program who come up to me at the end and are willing to say like, no, I do want to be the leader. I want to be the CEO of my company. And it's because I think I can make a positive difference. So to see somebody step into that kind of confidence, as well as knowing that their choices around leadership are not about ego, They are about wanting to do something better than what they're seeing done around them. To me, that's the impact, and those are the wins.
Susie's work within the intersection of disability and diversity in her Open Doors program was where she really felt that she helped the most.
Primarily around Open Doors is probably the best examples of it, because we really did make a difference for families. Because when I left the department, I said, I'm not helping any other families that are already being helped. We're going to help families that are not getting help that they need. And so I do think that I have made a difference in that.
Jan saw her greatest successes in the immigrants that she helped to get established within the United States after they had been detained, particularly the trans gypsy person that she talked about in her individual episode.
This trans person is very, very much still in my life, an amazing individual. And makes me so grateful that I took a chance and helped them get out of detention and have a good, healthy start, because they had spent a lot of time living on the streets in LA, had been through so much, and then, of course, had committed this crime. And it was like, I just had a feeling that this was going to be good, but there was no guarantee. And to watch them grow, to watch them come into their own and gain self-confidence, see that they really could do it, they really could be successful. Their bold assertions of, I'm going to be successful and I'm going to do all these things, watch them actually start coming true. You know, it's been a real privilege to watch this happen.
But Denise and Jessica prefer to operate at a grander scale. Denise's proudest achievement was addressing what sounds like hellish conditions in Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx.
So we listened to the people in the neighborhood, and they identified that garbage was an issue. And that was our first thing. The next thing was hospitals and what was happening in emergency rooms. And the fact that you could go to a hospital like Lincoln Hospital and be on an operating table with rats running across it. The fact that when they roll those carts in, and you know, the nurses' aides come in with the cart with people's medication, the pills that they're going to take that day, and in the little cups are roaches. So the conditions in Lincoln Hospital were abhorrent. And the folks that work there are, again, members of the community. Yeah, you have the sort of elite administrators, and you have, you know, doctors who stand at the left hand of God, you know. But the majority of people in hospitals are community folks, the nurses, the maintenance people cleaning the floors. And they knew that Lincoln Hospital was a butcher shop. They knew there were problems at Gouverneur Hospital on the Lower East Side. They knew there were problems at Metropolitan Hospital in East Harlem. You can go across the board. So I'm very proud of what we did, that we were able to push for change, that we were able to get politicians to respond to what we did in order to write legislation and get it passed. But you know what? 50 years or more have passed, and you now have the same problem again. So you need a whole nother group of young people to come at it in the best way possible now. But at least we're an example of what can be done.
Denise also set up a minority-controlled radio station, which then became a model for other radio stations across the country.
And, you know, you have this large public broadcasting system. PBS was obviously its television stations, and NPR now, people know as National Public Radio. But prior to that, you had community radio stations popping up all over the country, but they were white. And nobody was focusing on building that kind of station for a primarily Black audience. And D.C., Washington, D.C., which at that time was called Chocolate City with the Vanilla Suburbs, was a perfect place for that to happen. And so I'm very proud of what we did then. We showed that it was possible to do the kind of liberal, left, progressive, whatever, radio broadcasting in a community that was Black. And then we became an example for the building of stations. For example, there's one that broadcasts in South Dakota in both English and Lakota for the res. There were other stations that developed for the California Chicano community, for the Tejano community in Texas, and also developing programming that was not your sort of standard white liberal programming. And I'm very proud of having been part of building that and becoming an example for other minority controlled or people of color controlled media outlets in the country.
Jessica's biggest impact was getting the Washington, D.C. city government to start providing much needed health resources to the trans community.
Well, going back to my first needs assessment survey, which was very cheap, less than $22,000. We established the first HIV prevalence rate amongst trans women of color in the district. It was 32%. Almost one out of three women were living with HIV. Shortly after it was published, DC Department of Health, they provided the first HIV prevention funding to specifically focus on trans women. That was followed by the first transgender HIV program in Washington, and eventually Transgender Health Empowerment, the first trans-identified community-based organization in DC, was founded by my sister and colleague, Erlene Budd. Other DC agencies began to provide housing, substance use disorder recovery, and mental health services to trans people. And right after I finished the survey, I went to work for the local Gay Identified AIDS Service Organization. After three difficult years of internal advocacy, I got them to start the first trans health clinic in DC, where trans people could finally get their hormones and health exams in a safe, informed place. That's a specific example of what these kinds of needs assessment surveys can accomplish.
But for every victory, there are also failures.
Well, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, long refused to change their HIV surveillance to separate trans women from men who have sex with men. This invisibilization of trans women was not just transphobic, but epidemiologically inaccurate and ineffective. Their HIV prevention programming was very gendered, and so it's just ludicrous to expect gay male HIV prevention interventions to work with trans women. But in the reigning gay identity politics of the time, the gay men of CDC applied a scarcity principle that if they gave trans women funding for prevention, it would reduce their own funding for gay men. They were also quite cynical in protecting their gay male HIV funding from the stigma of transgenderism. So despite decades of trying, I failed to convince them to create a separate gender category for trans women at risk of living with HIV. Absent HIV prevention in a high-risk population, high HIV infection follows. So when I entered government, working for the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program, after another three difficult years, I successfully advocated for a demonstration project to improve access to HIV primary care for transgender women living with HIV. So sometimes when you lose, you have to go in a different direction. While working in the federal government, I did succeed in introducing to them what is called the two-step method for collecting data inclusive of trans people. These two steps are asking for sex assigned at birth and gender identity. Whenever they differ, a person is trans, non-binary, or gender non-conforming in some way. CDC eventually accepted this change in its HIV surveillance, but they still continue to present summary HIV statistics based upon male sex assigned at birth, which is inclusive of men who have sex with men, of course, and also trans women, with the latter disappearing in those stats. So sometimes when you succeed, you can also still fail.
For Belinda, the failures are not large scale, but happen at an individual conversation level.
I think for me, I'm trying to walk the line between sharing the facts, of which there are many, right, about the progress that we've made and the progress yet to go when it comes to gender equity. And certainly there's a lot of that data in my book and, you know, like all the information's there. So I'm walking the line between knowing this information and really sometimes just wanting to kind of like metaphorically shake the world and say, can you not see this? Like, does this not sound insane to the rest of you the same way it sounds insane to me? Are we okay with the fact that we just this year hit 10% women CEOs of Fortune 500? This year, 10%. We're good with that, right? Are we okay with the fact that the US has never had a woman president? Like, why, right? So these things to me seem so outrageous. And if we were to flip the gender role, people would be outraged. And yet, so many of us are not. And so I think I'm trying to walk that line of seeing that and yet not wanting to shut people down or alienate them or cancel them so that they then disappear from the dialogue. And sometimes when I'm in that place, I'm probably too diplomatic and not strong enough in what I'm saying because I'm trying hard not to exclude people. So that's where there are probably times where I could have used my voice in a stronger, more clear way. And I pulled my punch a little bit and I regret it. When I have conversations with people who truly disagree with equality, who tell me that it's actually not good for people, and it's too complicated and it's too disruptive and it's too expensive and we couldn't possibly. And not only that, it's not in human nature. When I hear that, I go to the dark place for a while because there's a part of me that doesn't believe that people believe it, but then people tell me this is actually what I believe. And so those are hard moments because it's like, okay, we're up against a lot here. We're not just up against unconscious bias. We're up against people intentionally choosing inequality.
Jan also saw a lot of failure in working with inmates, but she's really pretty philosophical about it.
Oh, well, yeah, with a lot of ex-offenders, but I knew going in, I can't make you be a different person. I can't change your behavior. Only you can do that. And so if you mess up, it's not on me. That's not my responsibility. I can give you all the tools for being able to make it out here and to change your lifestyle. But if you don't want to do it, you know, that's on you. and you will return to prison, I'm sure. But that's okay, because that's job security for me. You know, when you come out again, you'll be right back here. Keep me employed. So there's an obvious failure with that. And now that we've lost Roe, you know, there's some failure in promoting reproductive justice. And our wage gap continues to expand, you know. So, yeah, there are a lot of things where I failed. But then, did I have a right to expect that I would win? All I needed to do was do my part and try to make a difference. And the outcome, I'm not responsible for the outcome. I'm responsible for the effort.
Thanks as always for listening. Next week, we are going to continue this conversation about activism, looking at our guests' advice for getting started and staying active in making the world a better place. If you have any ideas for future guests or questions for us, you can reach us at lifeisfortheL on Twitter and Instagram, or email us at lifeisfortheLivingPodcast@gmail.com. The Life is for the Living podcast is written by me, Rebecca Richmond, and produced by Marco Berlow.